go to the calculus of variations or variational calculus. So these things are the same. So we will cover the following topics. So first of all, we will talk about functionals and functional derivatives. Then, as an example, we will talk about Lagrangian mechanics and Euler Lagrange equations. Then we will touch upon Noether's theorem and how one can obtain the first integrals and move to the topic of Euler Lagrange equations for continuous systems. Here I will consider an example how to calculate the energy momentum tensor. That is a very important example. And at the very end, if time permits, but this will be very brief anyway, I will talk about the Lagrange multipliers and variational calculus. So this is what we're going to do today and on Monday. So first of all, let me start with introducing such a notion as functionals. Functionals. So what is a functional? So I'm pretty much sure that many of you probably know this or heard this about this in the past, but functionals is defined in some kind of analogy with function. So if you have some kind of a function, then you have the variable that, for example, belongs to the space of real variables. And as an output, you get some other variable. For example, a real variable or complex variable, if you consider complex function. But function is something, say, that maps the space of real variables, for example, from minus infinity to infinity, onto the space of also real variables. So we take some point x naught, for example, belonging to the real axis, and get some other point belonging also to the space of real variables. This is for simplicity. You can have also, of course, complex functions. So, but in other words, for this example, we deal with the map that maps the space of real variables onto the space of a real variable. So this is what we mean by a function. And of course, in general, functions can have maxima, minima, in other words, extrema or extremal points. So in physics, people quite often look at the minima of the function or maxima, because these are the points that quite often appear to be special when we try to describe some kind of physical phenomenon or evolution of something. But we can ask a question. Can we take the functions or consider the space of all possible functions and as an output, return a number? And we can further ask a question whether we can choose a function that gives the minimal number. And this is where the notion of functional comes about. So for a functional, we take the space of functions denoted this way, meaning that they are infinitely many times differentiable. For simplicity, because typically in physics we deal with such types of functions. So take the space of functions. So this is the space of functions. Functions. And as an output, get some number. So get some number belonging also to the space of real variables. Well, we can, of course, have complex functionals as well. So in other words, The functional, and typically the corresponding letter for the functional is J. Is a map between the space of infinitely many times differentiable functions onto the space of real variables. So we enumerate all possible functions and look at what we get, what set of numbers we get as a result. So, of course, a natural question to ask whether we can choose a function that also minimizes something. For example, whether we have some kind of a process, and this process described by some function leads to a minimum of something or a maximum. And here we must consider such a thing as a functional derivative. So, functional derivative. So, consider the functional denoting this as J, and J is has some kind of dependence on infinitely many times differential functions. And this is denoted this way, J in square brackets. So as a function of functions. So since we're interested in the number, then it is natural to assume that the functional must imply the operation of integration. Because if you differentiate a function, you also get a function. But if you integrate a function, over some segment, then you get a number. So let's consider the functional of the following form. So we take a function of possible functions y and their first derivatives, and integrate over some segment belonging to the x-axis, say from initial point xi to the final point xf. And this functional, so this function f can also have an explicit dependence of x itself. Of course, higher derivatives are possible, but we will be dealing for simplicity only with the functions that depend either on y or y prime, and possibly x. So this is the form of the functional we're going to deal with. And we ask a question. What type of function y minimizes this functional, or in other words, give the smallest possible number as a result of substituting into this expression and integrating from xi to xf. So when we consider not functionals but functions, we look at the first derivative of this function. So here we can also do an analogous thing and look at the thing that is similar to the first derivative of a function. Namely, look at the first functional derivative of this functional j. So to consider this, let's look at the variation of this functional. So suppose that some function y minimizes this functional. Then the functions that are infinitesimally close to this given function will lead to higher values of the functional. So let's consider, let's assume that we have such a function y that minimizes the functional and vary this function around its minimum value, better to say extremal value, and consider this difference. j of y plus delta y minus j of y, where y is the presumed minimum and delta y is an infinitesimally small function denoted as epsilon times eta. So there, of course, the functions of x. So suppose that this function minimizes the functional, and we consider something very, very close to this function, infinitesimally close. And consider this expression. So integral xi from xi to xf, f y plus delta y, y prime plus delta y prime, comma x minus, okay, I will go here, minus f of y prime x dx. So delta y and delta y prime are infinitesimally small. So we expand what stands here with respect to the small parameters delta y and delta y prime. Psi xf df over dy delta y plus df over dy prime delta y prime plus something of the order of delta y squared and the integral over dx. Yep.
What do we exactly mean by infinitely or by infinitesimally close?
Exactly mean that for each point x, the deviation from the function that is presumed to constitute minimum is infinitesimally close. So say in other words, so here delta y is a function of x. Let's call it this way, smaller than some epsilon for any value of x. It's a more mathematical definition. So this is what we mean. So in other word, we also consider the space of function that cannot, for example, blow up potentially for any value of x between xi and xf. So here it is important to understand that these derivatives have their formal meaning. We differentiate this function f with respect to its argument that is a function itself. So how should we proceed further? We must deal with this term, because it contains the derivative of delta y. So we will deal with it by imposing a special condition, namely that the deviation delta y is zero at the boundaries. So this is the condition, it's called the condition of fixed boundary conditions. Delta y of xi equal to delta y of xf, initial and finite, a equal to zero. This condition is essential. This just means that nothing is allowed to vary at the ends.
That epsilon that you have there in principle depends on each x, right?
No, it's better to view it as some infinitesimally small variable that is uniform over the whole set segment. It's just a more mathematical definition that is analogous to the definition of the uniform convergence. So because when we can put forward the question what happens if one function converges to the other. So we have to assume the condition of uniform convergence that for any argument, so of interest, so we can find epsilon that tends to zero. So by imposing this condition is quite essential and allows us to treat this second term that can be integrated by part. So let's integrate by part this term and get df over dy minus d over dx df over dy prime, so plus O delta y squared over dx. So yeah, times of course here the delta y. Sorry, delta y plus O of delta y squared dx. So the coefficient that stands before delta y is called the first functional derivative and is denoted as delta j over delta y. First functional derivative. So we integrated this term by part, and due to these boundary conditions, so the contributions from the points xi and xf disappeared, and we arrive at this expression, and what stands before delta y once again is called the first functional derivative. The functional derivative of j with respect to y. So let me make also here the following remark that this functional derivative, okay, can be interpreted in the following way. So note the notation. We don't use the usual lattice for the differential operator D, but instead, it is more preferable to use deltas. So if we consider all possible points between xi and xf, we can say that, so note, delta j is equal to the sum of all i's of d j over d y I delta I, and if we go to continuous limit, then we convert the sum into the integral and formally get this expression involving the first functional derivative. So if we break our segment between xi and xf into some point and consider the discrete set of points here, and assume that yi here in this sum is the point corresponding to xi, then delta j can be viewed as a sum of the normal derivative of the normal derivative of j with respect to the value yi times delta yi. And if we go to continuous limit, then we get this expression. This is how the functional derivative can be interpreted in general. So it's not the ordinary derivative as we used to deal well with when we consider the function. It is just the limit of this sum.
When one tries to find the stationary points, mm-hmm. right, how do you characterize if it's a minimum or maximum?
I will explain. I will explain it a little bit later. So we have to look at the second functional derivative. So, yeah.
Okay, but the functional derivative gives me a number?
The functional derivative gives you a function.
Right.
So typically it's some kind of a differential operator.
If I want to take from, for example, from usual calculus that it's a maximum if the second derivative is.
I will talk. I'm sorry. I will talk a little bit later about this. So currently we have only the first functional derivative, and there is a theorem. The theorem that the functional j of y is stationary under fixed endpoint variations y of x going to y of x plus delta y of x if and only if the first functional derivative delta j over delta y is equal to zero for all x belonging to the segment xi to xf. So this means that the condition of equality to zero of the first functional derivative gives us the set, gives us in this case only one equation that is called Euler-Lagrange equation. To say this way, next. So this is Euler-Lagrange equation. So this condition is the necessary and sufficient condition for the functional of the above written form to be stationary. So as you can see, in general, this gives us a differential equation whose right-hand side must be equal to zero. Any questions? So for this equation, we presume that f is known. It's a function of all possible functions. And to determine the function that gives a stationary point or an extremum, as one can draw the analogy with the ordinary functions, we must solve this differential equation. Mm-hmm. Okay. There are other variations if we consider other boundary conditions. at the boundary conditions that are not fixed. We, in fact, can a priori choose other boundary conditions at the endpoints. For example, this is especially important if we consider Euler Lagrange equation for continuous system. Or we, for example, have the functional of many variables, I will talk, or better to say, many degrees of freedom. Here, when we have the functional only of one variable, it is more customary to consider the case of fixed boundary conditions. More customary, but for more complicated cases, for example, a functional of many degrees of freedom, we can impose more complicated conditions at the boundary. So in this case, we are still going to have the same set of Euler Lagrange equations, but the possible solutions must be further restricted, taking into account more complicated boundary conditions. This is the simplest case. Okay, so all this machinery can be generalized to the case of functionals with many degrees of freedom. Of course, nothing prohibits us from having the functional involving only one function y. We can have many other functions. For example, we can consider the following functional, j of y1 and so forth of yn equal to the same integral from, so let's call it this xi xf of f y1 yn y1 prime yn prime, then possibly depending explicitly on x itself, dx. So in this case, we have to find the set of functions y1, yn that gives the stationary point of this functional. So we can repeat this procedure and obtain the set of Euler Lagrange equations . So for the case when we have many functions, so df over dyi of x minus d over dx, df over dy prime of x equal to 0 for I equal to 1 to n. So here we have to solve the system of differential equations that is more complicated. Yeah, so thank you. Yeah. Okay, so when we derive these equations, we assume that yi vary independently. Independently satisfy the fixed boundary conditions. So, as a simplest example where this can be used, we can consider the Lagrange mechanics. So the Lagrange mechanics was introduced by Joseph Louis Lagrange, the French physicist and mathematician, apparently in the 18th century, to answer the question why, say, rigid bodies or material points move along this or that specific trajectory. So the motion along the trajectory is some kind of a process, a particle or a material point, how it is customary to have in mechanics, moves along some trajectory, and this is a process. And the question is, does this trajectory minimize something? And apparently this was the reasoning behind why Lagrange decided to introduce this machinery that is based on the functional that that was called action. Well, to be honest, I don't know what is the origin of the word action, because when a particle moves, then it doesn't act on something, but this is how this notion of action was introduced. So action is a functional. Action is a functional, and it is written in the following form. The integral over time, because we describe the process in time, between initial moment and the final moment, so of kinetic energy minus potential energy. And we must find the trajectories x as a function of time that minimizes this functional. Action for a particle moving in external field. So let's look at the Euler-Lagrange equations. So for example, if the motion occurs in the three-dimensional space, then x vector x can be written as x1, x2, and x3, having three components. And we must write down the Euler-Lagrange equations for each component. So we must have d over dt of what stands here. Let's denote this as L, capital letter, d over dt of dl over what dx I dot minus dl over dx I. So equal to 0. I can assume the values 1, 2, and 3 corresponding to the coordinates of the particle moving in three-dimensional space. So L is called Lagrangian. Lagrangian. So in mechanics, this function F has a specific name, and it is called Lagrangian. So if we look at the Lagrangian, we first of all should look for the dependence on the first derivative with respect to time. So if we write down this, we're going to have d over d dt times m x I dot minus d v over d x I equal to 0. Or equivalently, m x I double dot minus d v over d x I equal to 0. This is the famous second Newton's law. Apparently, Lagrange already knew about the second Newton's law and probably all other laws. Yeah. Yeah, plus, absolutely, yeah. Thank you, yes. So this is the second Newton's law. So that it can be written in the form mx I double dot equal to minus dv over dxi. And this is the thing called force, or better to say the ith component of the force. So apparently Lagrange knew about the Newton's laws and has the question whether the Newton's, whether the second Newton's law can be something, can result in some function that minimizes some functional called action. So in general, the motion of many bodies or many particles or many material points can be described by, of course, more complicated Lagrangians that are most conveniently written in terms of the so-called generalized coordinates. So Cartesian coordinates so do not constitute the only possible choice how one describes the motion of the system of particles. So in general, in mechanics, actions are the functionals involving the generalized coordinates, let's call it qi. So the integral between initial moment and the final moment, then Lagrangian that depends on the generalized coordinates. First, derivatives with respect to time and time itself. Qi are the generalized coordinates. So this is the set of coordinates that characterizes the motion of the system of particles in the most complete way. And again, this is called Lagrangian. Lagrangian and the Euler-Lagrange equations will have the following form: d over dt, dl over dqi dot minus dl over dqi equal to zero. So a good example is the motion of one particle along the closed circle. For example, we have the circle of the radius r, and we have the particle, point-like particle, that moves along this closed circle. In this case, of course, it is not very convenient to characterize the motion using the Cartesian coordinates x and y, but instead, the appropriate way is to introduce angle theta. So can we introduce the Lagrangian that is a function of the angle theta that is itself a function of time? Yes, we just have to switch to polar coordinates, x equal to r cosine theta and y equal to r sine theta. So r is constant, meaning that x dot is equal to minus r sine theta, theta dot, and y dot equal to r cosine theta, theta dot, right? And if we make this change of variable looking at our functional S of x without the potential energy, without v, then we can write that S of theta equal to the integral between ti and tf, m over 2 r squared. So let me write in a more detail. X dot squared plus y dot squared dt equal to the integral between ti and tf m over 2. If we substitute these expressions, we will immediately see that the angle theta disappears, and we have only theta dot squared times r squared times theta dot squared dt. So the Euler-Lagrange equation using the generous coordinate theta will be as follows. D over dt. So there is no explicit dependence of what is important on theta. And we have d over dt times, so d over dt of m r squared theta dot equal to 0. Or because r is constant, we get simply theta double dot equal to 0, meaning that the most general solution will have the form theta as a function of t equal to theta naught plus omega t, where omega is the angular frequency and theta naught is the initial angle at point ti. So any questions how this works in general? So during your tutorial, you will see a more complicated example in which you have to construct the Euler-Lagrange equations given the specific forms of Lagrangians.
Yeah. Probably the question is, why do we need the action to be stationary? What's the physics behind it?
This is just a convenient formalism. So you can put forward the question in a more general way. Why do we need functionals in physics that minimize something if we have already the equations that describe the motion? So it's a good question. And to be honest, I myself don't see the very convincing reason behind that. Absolutely.
Generally, when the problem is really complicated, you use the Lagrangian formalism and derive the solution for that.
You can construct and try to solve the Newton's equation even for more complicated problems.
Right.
In fact, so in this case, the variation principle does not add anything.
All right, so it's a kind of equivalent, but no.
But from the other side, this variation principle has proven to be very useful in quantum mechanics, where Feynman derived his famous approach. So the classical trajectories correspond exactly to the minima or extremal values of the action. Energy conservation, and I will talk later, in fact, it can be derived from the Newton's law. So it's a first integral. So it's a good question. So any other questions or comments about this? Mm-hmm.
When you talk about the functional for the case of multiple functions, uh-huh. You assume that you could vary all the functions independently?
Yes.
But in this case, there's a constraint, right? You can't, like, the x and y's are constraints of the equation. So, I mean, is it obvious that you can just apply that formula? Like, I know that it works, but is it obvious that you can just apply
I understand your questions. Yeah, there we implied that we can vary the functions independently. Here, we can't vary them independently. So initially, we had two coordinates, two degrees of freedom. But the artificial constraint, and it is an artificial constraint. If you, for example, have a circular wire and the bead that sits on this wire, and you give a punch to this bead, then it is going to move along this circular wire. Yeah. Yeah.
But in the discrete one, you have regular partials, regular y. Do we actually mean to write df?
I actually, yeah, very good. Thank you. Yeah. 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 It is df. Yeah. 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 Thank you very, very much. Yeah. I will correct this in my notes. So yeah, here we have the system with a particular constraint. When you have many degrees of freedom, and so say many particles, and they're not allowed to move independently, then this means that we already have some kind of a constraint. And the constraints, the degrees, the number of the relative degrees of freedom. So if we have constraints, then the first question which we should ask ourselves, how this is going to reduce the number of degrees of freedom. Because if particles are not non-interacting and independent, then they move independently. So Theodore, thank you for pointing this out. So. Then our question is, the question that Andres asked about whether this stationary point is a minimum or maximum or something else or something probably in between. So when we deal with the function, quite often we can say whether the extremum is minimum or maximum, say function of one variable. The situation is more complicated if we deal with the minimum of the function of, or extremum of the function of many variables. So if we have a function of one variable, quite often we can for sure tell whether we deal with the minimum or the maximum by looking at the second derivative. So the question is here, the question here is similar, whether the stationary point is a minimum or maximum or something in between. And here we deal with the notion of second functional derivative. So let me move to the side. Second functional derivative. So let's assume that we have the functional, and we know the function y that gives the stationary point. Let's consider the functional of y plus delta y and expand this function with respect to delta y. So we have j of y plus the integral delta y of x delta j over delta y equal, okay, here let's consider y naught. So y naught of x is the solution of the Euler-Lagrange equation. And we consider the functional of the function y that is very close to the solution y naught, dx plus, we can of course try to expand further with respect to delta y and keeps the terms of the second order in delta y. We get delta y of x1, delta y of x2, and something that is that can be formally written in this form, delta squared j, or better to say, delta y of x1, delta y of x2, with y substituted by y0 of x, that is solution of the Euler-Lagrange equation, dx1, dx2. So this is 0, because y0 satisfies the Euler-Lagrange equation. And what stands? What stands next involves something that is a function of both x1 and x2 that themselves vary again between the initial point xi and the final point xf. So what stands here is called the second functional derivative. Second functional derivative. It has a complicated form, and there is not much sense for us to try to identify its explicit form. It's essential that here we have the double integral. So while calculating the first functional derivative, we dealt with one integral. Here we deal with double integral. Yeah. X1 and X2, they're just variables of integration that lie between xi and xf. Yes, and it is essential that we're likely to see here some quite complicated differential operator. We already have the differential equation when we try to solve Euler-Lagrange equation. Here, we will also have some kind of differential operator that is going to be quite complicated in general. So to answer the question whether we have a minimum or a maximum or something in between, we have to look at the spectrum of second functional derivative, or better to say, at the spectrum of this complicated differential operator. So if the spectrum of the second functional derivative is positive, then in analogy to the minimum of an ordinary function, we also have the minimum of a functional. If it is negative, we have a maximum. But quite often, the spectrum is something in between that has both positive and negative eigenvalues. In this case, we call our solution to the Euler-Lagrange equation a saddle point solution. So to be honest, I never checked myself. I never did this procedure myself, even for the very simple case. But this is the general rule.
And evaluating the function that gives me a function, right? So saying that it's positive or negative is for all x in the
here if you look at the left hand side, you are likely to encounter a differential operator, a differential equation. So here you have the similar differential operator in the space of functions.
Right.
And you have to find somehow its eigenspectrum.
So the second functional differential will give you a functional, which you then just apply to that. The solution is the order for the equation, and that will give you that.
So say it again. So
you take the second functional
You substitute the solution. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you calculate this object, then you must plug the solution over the Euler Lagrange equation. So that is presumed known. And this will give you a function of x. Well, here you have a function. You will have a function when you substitute the solution to the Euler Lagrange equation here. You will still have some kind of a function of x1 and x2.
And then when you integrate over,
you don't have to integrate over. No. You will have the function of x1 and x2 that will have quite a complicated form, and you look at the eigenspectrum of this object.
So somehow, when I have, for example, a Lagrangian, one can use any other argument to know if it's a minimum or a maximum or a stable point instead of looking for the second function and derivative.
I'm afraid I'm not aware of this.
So it depends from you on the form of the
letter. Yeah, yeah. To be honest, I never encountered the discussion regarding this issue in the textbook. This may indeed raise further questions about the necessity and the importance of this variational approach. We have a few 15 more minutes, and what we're going to consider, we're going to consider some tools that will allow us to obtain the general solution to the Euler Lagrange equation when we have many degrees of freedom. So let's consider such a thing called a first integral. Okay. Oh, yeah, sure.
The restriction that you place on the space of functions by insisting on Lagrangian. Do you know if that you still get this property that you can have mixed spectrum?
You mean
J there has an action.
Right. Yeah.
Do you know if that makes any difference?
What the possible restrictions may make any difference? I don't know. It's a complicated thing. If you impose restrictions, then this cuts the number of your degrees of freedom. But whether this affects the character of the stationary solution, stationary point of the function. So I don't know. It's not very convenient to use the board when it is wet or damp. It's difficult to erase chalk afterwards. Okay. First integral. First integral of the Euler Lagrange equations. So suppose we deal with the mechanical problem and consider the Lagrangian that depends on many generalized coordinates, say q1, so forth, qn, q1 dot. By q1 dot, I mean the derivative with respect to time, just for you to be aware of notation. Typically, when there is a derivative with respect to coordinate variable, people use the prime. And when they consider the derivative with respect to time, they use dots on top of the latter. So forth, q n dot. So of course, one can have, in addition, the explicit dependence on time. But we will consider the case in which this dependence is absent. So consider the case where we don't have explicit dependence on time. No explicit time dependence. No explicit time dependence. And we ask a question. Can we derive something that will facilitate the solution of the general system of Euler-Lagrange equation? So for this case, the Euler-Lagrange equations will be d over dt, dl over dqi dot minus dl over dqi equal to 0. We all already know that. So can we find something useful based on the fact that Lagrangian does not depend on time explicitly, but depends only on the general coordinates and their first time derivatives? So the answer is yes. And to see this, we must consider the derivative, the full or total derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to time. So dl over dt, given our dependencies, will be sum of I of d partial derivative of l with respect to qi times qi dot plus dl over dqi dot times qi double dot. So there is, because L does not depend on time explicitly, here we have no partial derivative of L with respect to T. So this is our full derivative. So what we're going to do next, we look at the Euler-Lagrange equation and multiply each equation by qi dot and sum all of them. So we have the following. The right-hand side is 0, and it will remain 0 when we do this procedure. So we have the following. So let me denote this equation by star I. Multiply each star I by qi dot and sum all of them, all equations. So we will have sum over all I, qi dot d over dt dl over dq dot I minus qi dot dl over dqi equal to 0. Then what we will do next, we will work with this first term in this sum. We will rewrite it in the following way: d over dt, sum over all I, qi dot dl over dqi dot, right? Minus sum over I, dl dqi dot qi, here dot double dot, plus qi dot dl over dqi equal to 0. We just worked with the first term here and use the chain rule, taking the derivative with respect to t. So, but what's this? This is nothing else than the full derivative of L with respect to t. Thus, we can write that d over dt of the following construction, sum of I qi dot dl over dqi dot minus L is equal to 0, meaning that sum over EI QI dot DL over DQI dot minus L itself is equal to constant. So this quantity that does not depend on time, and it has the special name. Does anyone know how this quantity is called? Exactly. Yeah, this quantity is called energy and is denoted by letter E. Energy that is constant in time. So in other words, this constitutes the first integral of motion of the system of Euler-Lagrange equations. The first integral because we multiplied by the first derivative of qi dot. So this means that knowing the Lagrangian and knowing that it doesn't depend on time explicitly, we have already some conserved quantity that is constant in time. This allows us to simplify the problem and simplify the number of differential equations. We simplify and reduce the number of differential equations we have to solve to obtain the solutions to the Euler-Lagrange equations explicitly. It is important that this integral called energy exists only if the Lagrangian does not depend on time explicitly, meaning that we're considering the system of closed particle in the absence of time-varying external fields. Any questions with that? Because I believe it's a good time to stop here. So later we will see that there are other integrals of motion. Other integrals of motion are the first integrals, and there is a general way how to obtain them, to use Noether's theorem after observing all possible symmetries of a Lagrangian. So any questions? So if there are no, yeah.
In the case in which your Lagrangian depends on time, there is also a conservation law, but in terms of the density of states, right?
What do you mean by the density of states?
Here I have no time dependence, but if I ask, for example, that the Lagrangian has some symmetry in time, I will always get into some conservation law.
If the Lagrangian has a symmetry,
right? I mean,
for example, periodic condition or.
I mean, it's periodic in time or something like that. I will also get something like this with other terms, so that somehow energy might be varying in time, but it's flowing into other system or anything like that.
In this case, most likely you will have energy, so something like that, but that varies in time. It is restrictive. This means that the system you are trying to describe moves in the absence of time-dependent external field. This means that the system does not exchange energy, our current system, with external world. It is restrictive, yeah. So from the other side, if you consider, you can consider the motion of the system under the influence of very slowly varying external field. In this case, there are quantities called adiabatic invariants that are approximately constant with respect to time. But it's a quite complicated area of classical mechanics. Not talking about quantums, but there are such things as adiabatic invariants. Or you can consider, for example, the motion in under the influence of forces that vary periodically in time. For example, oscillate quickly in time. In this case, you can also raise the questions of what quantities almost don't change with times or don't change if we vary with respect to oscillations of the external forces. But in general, yes, it's a complicated area. Yeah, okay, probably we should stop here.